Okay, so we are now a week from Rosh Hashanah.
We are.
Yeah, next Thursday. Next Wednesday night is the first day. It's crazy, right? Okay, so we're a week before Rosh Hashanah. So I figured we would talk about crying. And there's a lot to say about crying. But in terms of how it relates to Rosh Hashanah, it's funny. Yeah, usually crying is...
Svarim don't cry.
Yeah, men don't cry. Svarim don't cry. Okay, so let me pose this question. Do you guys think it's appropriate to cry on Rosh Hashanah? You think we should cry on Rosh Hashanah? We should not cry on Rosh Hashanah? What do you guys think?
Should.
We should, okay. Why should we?
Asking for mercy.
Okay.
More for Yom Kippur.
More appropriate for Yom Kippur. Okay.
But if you do both, more.
More for Yom Kippur.
I don't think you should cry, but you should be crying the whole time. Like, you should be like... I don't think you should, like, be crying the whole entire year during Rosh Hashanah. I'm saying, like, certain times, like, 10, like, I don't know, however, like, short period.
Then you should have a box of tissues.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, a pocket. Not a box. Pocket.
And what, so if you think about it more, what is the crying stemming from? The crying that you should be doing, as you're saying?
Guilt. Like we learned, not shame, but guilt.
Not shame, but guilt, okay. Okay, nice bridge of the last week and this week. So you're crying for guilt, because you feel bad about your averos.
Right.
And you're being judged. Okay. Any other thoughts about should we cry, should we not cry? You're saying it's more appropriate on Yom Kippur.
Both is good.
Yeah.
I mean, there's different ways of crying. You could be crying because you're happy for something. As in something really good, like Hashem, I don't know, put something in someone's hands. You know, sometimes, you know, their emotions, like moving really rapidly. So it might lead them to cry something, you know? So, I mean, in a way, in a positive way. Cry in a positive way.
Good. Okay, so as we'll see a little bit later, crying is very complex, and there's many different reasons why we cry. Sometimes there's sadness, sometimes it's happiness, sometimes it's fear. So you're right, crying could take on a number of different aspects, and so maybe some are more appropriate for Rosh Hashanah, maybe some are not. Okay, so it's actually a machlokas, as with most things in Judaism, it's actually a machlokas whether we should cry on Rosh Hashanah. Yeah, so look at source one. Source one is the Vilna Gaon, the Gra, who was known for his rational, you know, more intellectual side, but obviously he had an emotional side. But he says that, or his minug in source one, Ve'ein libkos b'Rosh Hashanah kemevur be'ezra, as the pasuk says in Ezra, al tivku. So he says it's not, we shouldn't cry in Rosh Hashanah, because there's a pasuk in Ezra, which is source 2. This is describing when Bnei Yisrael came back from the exile in Bavel. So they came back to Eretz Yisrael to build the second Beis HaMikdash. And many of them had lost a lot of the Torah. They weren't keeping it. So Ezra brought out a Sefer Torah and read from it. And they all started bawling because they heard, you know, all these mitzvos, all these averos, and what are we doing? We're married to non-Jewish wives. We're not keeping Shabbos. And they started just crying. And Ezra turns to them and he says, don't cry. So if you look in source 2, look at the second line. Ezra says, Al tisablu, don't be depressed. Va'al tivku, and don't cry. Ki bochim kolam, because everybody was crying. And then he says, Vayom alahem, l'chu ichlu mashmanim, ushsu mamtakim, go eat delightful foods, drink, v'shilchu manos, and give gifts to each other, ki kadosh hayom adoneinu, because today is holy. And you see in the Navi, the Ksuvim actually, that day was Rosh Hashanah. So the Vilna Gaon says, you see from these psukim that because it was Rosh Hashanah, Ezra told them not to cry. So it's not appropriate to cry in Rosh Hashanah. Okay, so that's one opinion. But then if you look in source 3, the Arizal, the great Kabbalist, the Ari, so says the Be'er Heitev, Ha'ariza Nag Libkos B'Rosh Hashanah V'Yom HaKippurim, right, the Ari would cry in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and listen to this, The Amar, Mi She'eno Boche B'Yom Elu, somebody who does not cry on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, Az Ein Nishmaso Tova Ushlema. It's a sign that their neshama is not good and complete. Very powerful words, especially, you know, obviously he's not talking about the Gra, but very powerful words. And then he says something else, which is amazing. Gam Amar, Kol Mi Sheboche Az Me'atzmo, you know, this happens sometimes. We'll just sort of spontaneously just break out into crying. Sometimes there'll be an event or something that we see or something that we hear that will cause the crying to come out. But sometimes, either out of nowhere or not when you think it's going to happen to you, you just sort of burst out crying. So the Ari says, when that happens on Rosh Hashanah, if you just sort of spontaneously burst out and cry, Osa Shah, Danin also bebeisin shamayla. It means that in heaven they're actually judging you right then at that moment. V'nafsho mageshes, and your nefesh, your soul is feeling that, and therefore that comes out in that spontaneous cry. So the Ari says, first of all, it's appropriate to cry in Rosh Hashanah. If you don't cry, there's something wrong with your neshama. And when you feel yourself spontaneously crying, it means that there's actually a judgment going on in shamayim. So we have these two seemingly polar opposite shitas, right? The Gra, don't cry, it's a happy day. The Ari, you should cry, it's a good thing to cry. There's something wrong with your neshama if you don't cry. So how do we reconcile these two shitas? So let's go into the psychology a little bit. So the world's expert psychologist on crying is a guy from Switzerland named Ad. His first name is Ad, A-D, Vingerhoetz. It's probably not how you say it, but so he's a Swiss researcher. Yeah, Swiss. Okay, so he's been studying crying for over 20 years. He's the world's expert on crying. It's actually funny. They do a study every year, world's happiest countries, and they rank the happiest countries. And every year, the happiest countries are always Switzerland, Denmark, all the Sweden, all those countries in that area. So it could be, since he's from Switzerland and he's always happy, he can study crying for 20 years and not be brought down.
What about the happiest man that's in Hawaii? Have you heard of that?
Happiest man, it could be, but they're ranking the happiest countries in general. Meaning not individual, but...
They say that the happiest people live in Hawaii,
okay.
And then from there, they say Asians are usually happier. They say 250,000 to 300,000 paid salary is a good, like a happy salary. Yeah. They're doing all based off of facts, and then they said he had... If he said three children is like happy, it's like the perfect amount of happiness.
Okay. Yeah. I'll maybe when we do a shiur on happiness, I'll bring that. They do a ranking every year of these countries, so it could be you're talking about a separate study. But whenever countries are ranked, it's always Switzerland, Denmark, all those countries come out of them. Yeah. So we can get into that when we do that one. Okay. But let's get back to here. So he's the world's expert on crying.
Can actually be a happy person, more happy than that person, but on paper they're the happiest.
Okay, so let's see what he says on crying. So he says a lot on crying. I could probably speak for hours on everything he says, but one really fascinating thing that he discovered is that if you think about crying developmentally, right, so we start crying at about 2 months old, right? Why does a baby cry?
What do you mean, we're born crying?
We're born crying, yeah, exactly. Right, I'm sorry. Crying itself happens right as we come out, but emotional crying, meaning crying that signifies an emotion of distress or of pain, that comes at about 2 months. What's called, because what you see, which is really interesting, is that when a baby cries until 2 months, they don't have tears. It's only at about 2-3 months when they start getting tears, which is linked to the emotional side of crying. Meaning before that, it's just, I want food, I have a dirty diaper or something. But then at 2-3 months is when they first get that, you know, something bothers them, they realize that there's something else in life besides themselves. So we start from a very young age crying, right? And then as we get older, we sort of hold it in. We limit our crying. We learn to not cry for everything, hopefully. Some people don't, but most of us do. And then, as we get older, we realize that we do cry, but it's for other things than what we cry for as children. So look at number 4 on the sheet. So he did an amazing thing. He took He basically analyzed how people cry across the lifespan, and he showed how the antecedents, which is just a fancy word for saying a reason to cry, right? Something that causes you to cry, an antecedent, that all the antecedents in young childhood are negative. So look at the look at number four, look at the left side of that column. So we have loss or grief, a divorce, breakup, separation, conflict, loneliness, defeat, powerlessness, right? So all these things, which also cause adults to cry, but these are the things that cause young children or teenagers to cry. And then what he showed is that later in life, you have sort of the polar opposite of those, sort of what we were saying, the happy cry, right? Maybe the positive side of that, but that also causes a cry. So for instance, the counter to lost grief, if you look on the right side, is like the birth of a child, right? I'll confess that when my first kid was born, I cried. It was like such a emotional, happy event. I wasn't crying because of sadness. It was a happy, just, I was overflowing with emotion.
Usually they say you, microscopically, they see different kind of tears.
Say it again?
I once heard that different events, they have different tears. It looks different.
Different kinds of tears. Yeah, there's some research that I think emotional tears have more protein in them than just like tears like when you cry from cutting an onion, which have no emotion, and emotional tears have different consistency chemically, biologically. Yeah, that was a study in the 70s. So fascinating. So basically what he's showing here is that the crying that we do in childhood sort of expresses itself in adulthood, it could express itself in the opposite, the counter event, right? So if there's something sad that happens or a feeling, so the counter to that in adulthood is also brings on crying. So we see, as we said, that crying could be from sadness, could be from happiness. And then if you look at the quote after, the way he sums it up is that the key antecedents to crying, so here's the three: helplessness, hopelessness, and lack of adequate behavioral responses to a problem situation, right? So basically when we feel like we don't know what to do, that's when crying comes out, okay? We feel like we can't do anything when we feel we don't know what to do. We're helpless, we're hopeless, or we sort of can't figure out how to solve a situation.
Based on age or just...
He said these are the main antecedents to crying across the lifespan. You could have the positive ones, which we talked about also, but the main ones are these: helplessness, hopelessness, and not knowing what to do in situations, okay? So let's look at source. We'll skip the Shem Yishmael for now. Let's look at source 6. So source 6 is fascinating, and I've seen this with my own kids. You might have seen this with other kids. So it's what's called the two-stage theory of crying. So this is what happens like neurobiologically in the brain. So when there's something that gets us scared or frightened or we're fearful of, but we don't know what to do, so we go into the sympathetic nervous system, which you've probably learned is like the flight or fight response. Basically, your body reacts by getting ready to like either fight the threat or run away. But at that point, there's no room for crying because your body's in that tense, like, I'm just survival mode, right? That's a sympathetic nervous system. Then, once the whatever's causing you that feeling goes away, then your body sort of relaxes and goes into the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the more normal functioning of the body. So you'll see this with kids, right? You'll see, this is fascinating, I've seen this with my own kids. They'll fall, something will happen to them, somebody will hit them, right? And many times you'll see that the kid will just be like in shock, and then when they turn and they see the parent or they see the teacher, somebody who they feel safe with, then they'll start crying, right? Right? But they won't start crying until they feel that safety, because their body's still in that sympathetic mode of, you know, fear and flight or fight and what do I do? Then once they see a safe, person, a comfortable, safe person, then their system lets itself cry. Okay? So that's this two-stage theory of crying from different researchers. So using that theory, I want to come back to crying on Rosh Hashanah. So let's look at source 7. Source 7 is about crying on Shabbos. So we know that we're not supposed to cry on Shabbos in general. Shabbos is supposed to be a day of happiness, a day of oneg, a day of pleasure, and crying is not usually associated with pleasure. So, and we know that in terms of avelos, when somebody is mourning for a loved one, so they don't express their avelos in public on Shabbos, right? It's only in private, but on Shabbos we don't want any public displays of sadness. But, quotes the Rama in Simin Reish Peches, he says, V'chein, misha yeshlo. So he's talking about what constitutes oneg. What, for each person, what is pleasurable for you? So most people, it's pleasurable to eat on Shabbos. That's why we have elaborate meals. That's why we have three. That's why we eat. But he says, somebody who, for a medical condition or they're on a diet, whatever it is, if, for them, eating specific foods or just eating in general is not pleasurable, right? It actually hurts them. It gives them a stomach ache. So then they wouldn't have a chiyuv to eat on Shabbos because that's not pleasure for them. So the Rama quotes in the same vein, V'chein mi sheyesh lo oneg im yivka. If for somebody, crying will actually give them pleasure, then what? Kedei sheyelech hatzar milibo, that the crying will take out the pain that's in their heart, then mutter lifkos b'Shabbos. Then it's okay to cry on Shabbos. Because that's oneg, that's pleasure for the person. Because it gives him the relief. It gives him that release of pain on Shabbos. Okay, so for most people, just to cry stam or out of sadness, where it's not necessarily gonna relieve pain or tension, it wouldn't be appropriate on Shabbos. But if it accomplishes that, then it's mutter on Shabbos. Says the Mishnah Brura in source 8, quoting the Taz, because of Ataz, Hainu dafka imachmas rov dvekuso b'kadosh baruch hu, zolgim einav demos. When do we say it's mutter to cry on Shabbos? It's only if you're crying because of this intense feeling of connection to Hashem. And because of that intense connection, you're crying. Shekein matzinu b'Rabbi Akiva, b'Zohar chada, shaya bochem ma'od, that there's a story that Rabbi Akiva, the great Rabbi Akiva, when he was reciting Shir HaShirim on Shabbos, I know Sephardim have the minhag to say Shir HaShirim on Shabbos, right? Or Mincha before Shabbos, right? So when he would say Shir HaShirim on Shabbos, he would just cry. He would bawl, he would cry. But what was that from? That was from, because he knew the deep meaning, the deep significance of Shir HaShirim, the relationship between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that brought him to tears, the deep, intense connection that he felt between himself and HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
He says an interesting line, he shall have Dvarim Magiyim. She did that, she shall have Dvarim Magiyim. He's saying, you can't have a Matsu, and you have a kid, Matsu, who's following the Kavah. Like, you think, because you know where, you have a sense of where you are.
Right, meaning you know the significance of what you're doing. And you.
He's like, you know, it sounds like you, obviously, okay, Rekiva is a Rekiva, but he's saying, we also, when you follow the Kavanah, you sort of have a sense of like, you know you're hitting high notes. You're not
stopping, right. You know that it has a huge effect.
The tears come because you know you're like,
it's having it. Right, there. Right, exactly. So that's the key point. The key point, which I want to bring back, is that, what did we say, the two-stage theory, that you only cry, you only get into the parasympathetic mode of crying when you feel that connection with a parent, with a teacher, right? When the kid sees the parent, when the kid sees the teacher, that's when he lets himself cry, right? So therefore, our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the same thing. When do we cry? When is it appropriate to cry? Let's say on Rosh Hashanah or on Shabbos. When we feel that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is close to us, when we feel that he's the safe figure that we see that we always feel, and then we could let our emotions out. If we don't feel safe, if we always are in fear, or we don't feel connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then we're not going to cry, right? So I'll end with two amazing Divrei Torah about crying. One is the story in Sefer Shmos about Moshe Rabbeinu as a baby, right? So Yocheved puts him in the Nilos, and Basia, the daughter of Paro, comes to wash and in the river, and she hears a baby crying, right? So the psukim say she heard the baby crying, Vihine Nar Ivri Boch, I don't know the exact lashon, but she basically heard a Jewish baby crying. So many of the Mefarshim ask,
Jewish.
Right, how did you know it was Jewish? Right, it's a little baby crying, right? So many different explanations, but a beautiful one, which I've heard Rabbi Brander quote, I think it's from Rabbi Nevensal, is that a Jewish cry, not just a Jewish child, but a Jewish cry is qualitatively different than any other person's cry, because it's the way he says it, it's a cry which has hope in it. Now, why is it a cry that has hope in it? Because a Jewish neshama, is always connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So even when we don't feel it, right, many times we don't feel connected, even when we don't know it, right, but we're always connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore our cry always has that quality that we said from that two-stage theory, that parasympathetic cry, when we feel that safety, when we feel that closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And so when Basia heard that cry, she said, "Ah, that's a Jewish cry. I know that's qualitatively different." Okay, that's one vort. Second vort is related to the laning on Rosh Hashanah. We lain on the first day of Rosh Hashanah the story of Chana, the mother of Shmua, that she didn't have children for many years, and she would come to the Beis HaMikdash every year with her husband and her co-wife, Penina, who had many children, and she would daven to Hashem. And one year, she came, and her husband Elkanah told her, and she was crying, and Elkanah told her, you know, why are you crying? You know, aren't I better to you than 10 children? You know, you have a loving husband, and you know, I'm here to take care of you, to protect you. Don't cry. And then the psukim talk about how Dafka then that year she went and she cried much more intensely before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that's what a lot of our tefillah is based. A lot of the aspects of our tefillah is based on her crying, her davening, and for that cry she was rewarded the next year with the son Shmua, which she, you know, dedicated to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Soloveitchik asks, why did she only cry intensely that year? Right, every year she came and she cried for a child, she wasn't answered. So why was that year so qualitatively different? So he says an amazing thing. He says when she heard her husband tell her, right, don't cry, I'm better to you than 10 children. So she realized that
I say, I'm listening to the crying student, Torah say. Yeah, so frustrated.
Yeah.
I need to know that his Arizona, Daryl Kyle, and the Bar Mitzvah phrase, I wouldn't really.
It's Chatoi, Ani Maskira.
I'm not appreciating this year. It's really from Kashub Hashrecha.
Thank you. I'm quoting the Rav on Chana.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Beautiful.
So getting back, and with this we'll end. So the minute her husband told her, don't cry, Chana, I'm good for you, you don't need children, she realized that he doesn't understand me. He doesn't know the pain that I'm going through. And the only person, the only entity I have to rely on is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And once she felt that Hashem was the only thing, the only, she didn't have any people to turn to anymore. Until now she had her husband who she felt, you know, he could understand me, he sympathized with me. But once she heard that from her husband, she said, Ein li li shayin ela alavi shabbat shamayim, right? The only thing I have is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. She felt that intense connection because it was only her and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And then she poured out her heart, and that was the tefillah that was answered.
I think he said to her, don't worry, I'm good. Like, meaning basically, I'm good for nothing to help you get any more children. Just look at me as like your child.
Right. Meaning the basic idea is that he was telling her, you've davened for many years for children. It's enough already. You don't need them. You have me. You're fine. Right. So she felt at that point, he really doesn't. Yeah, until now, she felt he understood him. Yeah, or he was davening for her also. Once he gave up on her basically having children, then she's like, okay, I only have HaKadosh Baruch Hu, now I need to pour out my heart completely to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So getting back to Rosh Hashanah, so...
That was
the Soloveitchik.
Chana,
correct, Chana, which is the Haftorah that we read on, I believe, the first day of Rosh Hashanah. So getting back to our original question, is it appropriate to cry in Rosh Hashanah? So we had the Gra who says, no, we should be happy. We're coronating Hashem as our king. It's not appropriate to cry. We have the Ari who says, of course we should cry. How can you not cry? If you don't cry, there's something wrong with your neshama, right? So if you look at other sources, you'll see, like for instance, Rav Chaim Velazhner, one of the main Talmud, the main student of the Vilna Gaon, he said, for sure the Gra didn't mean it's never appropriate to cry in Rosh Hashanah. He meant it's inappropriate to cry out of, you know, intense sadness and a feeling of despair, a feeling of hopelessness. But if the cry, like we said by Rabbi Akiva on Shabbos, by Shir Hashirim, if the cry is coming from that feeling of closeness to Hashem, that feeling of dveikus, that I only have Hashem to rely on, then even the Gra would say it's appropriate to cry. So, the maskana, we're a week away before Rosh Hashanah. Whether we cry or not, that's up to you. If you want to cry, cry. If you don't want to cry, don't cry. But the main thing to remember, the main thing to do, whether you cry or not, is to feel that closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. To feel that on Yom HaDin, when we're sitting in judgment, we really do not have anybody else to rely on except HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if we feel that, then either we'll spontaneously cry, we'll bring ourselves to cry, or even if we don't, but if we have that feeling of dveikus, of intense connection with Hashem, and that we can't rely on anybody else, that will lead us to have the most meaningful and the most emotionally powerful tefillah on Rosh Hashanah and on Yom Kippur.